I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Pew Research Center recently did an extensive study of how police view their jobs. They interviewed 8,000 policemen and women from departments with at least 100 officers. The questions were interesting and the answers illuminating. We invited Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn and Police Officer Lorenzo Mahomes, who recently graduated from the Milwaukee Police Academy and is in his first 6 weeks of field training as a police officer, to join us in our Milwaukee studios to answer some pretty big questions. What is a good police officer? Are there serious concerns about physical safety? How often do officers use force? How important is it to know the people and the places they patrol? Are the deaths of blacks during encounters with police seen as isolated incidents? And how does that break down? It's an interesting difference between white officers and black officers. And importantly, what are the emotional costs of being a police officer? We're going to be talking about all of that this hour of the program, and we have two guests with us. Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn is here. He's been our guest several times before. Appointed Chief of the Milwaukee Police Department in 2008. He was sworn in for a third time in 2016. He commands an agency of 2,000 sworn officers, 700 civilians, serving a city of over 600,000 residents. Formerly police commissioner in Springfield, Massachusetts. He served as Secretary of Public Safety under Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. He was for 5 years chief of police in Arlington, Virginia. Began his career in the Jersey City Police Department and is a member of a number of interesting organizations, the Police Executive Research Forum, the Executive Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Executive Board, member of the Harvard Kennedy School Executive Session on Policing, and has won many awards for his work. Chief Flynn, nice to see you again. Hello.
Nice to see you again.
And he even sent me a paper that he wrote in 1984 about his favorite novelist and how his novelist really helped formulate his thoughts about the internal life of police officers. It was a good read. You were a good student.
Thank you. Yes, well, and we consider I was in kindergarten at the time.
All right.
It's all the more remarkable.
It is remarkable. Also joining us, and it's wonderful that he came to the station, is Police Officer Lorenzo Mahomes. He has lived in Milwaukee for 13 years, born and raised in Mississippi, worked at a manufacturing company on the northwest side of Milwaukee, and has recently graduated from the Milwaukee Police Academy, so he is just starting his work. 6 weeks he's in, the first 6 weeks of field training. Training as a police officer, living the dream, you say, huh?
Yes, ma'am. Living
the
dream.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us and so early on the job. Chief Flynn, pull the microphone up just a little bit closer.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I think it'll be a really interesting hour. And let's start with what was the theme of the Pew Research and also what's been the theme of scientists you've studied and also Joseph Wambaugh, the novelist, who is your favorite novelist, who look at this question of what is a good police officer? What's the answer to that, Chief Flynn?
Well, it depends who you ask, obviously. I think there's been a lot of work done, and the theme of my paper was that a well-regarded social scientist of the era named William Muir had done extensive study of policemen's working personalities to try to understand how it is they came to grips with the, physical and moral chaos with which they often had to deal firsthand, mm-hmm. and how did they resolve the idea of achieving just ends through coercive means. I mean, what distinguishes police officers is that they're the only local government workers in America that are lawfully empowered to use force to secure compliance with their directives. That imposes burdens on police officers. And interestingly enough, based on the author's research, the sociologist researched, he found those burdens actually placed limitations on the officer rather than additional freedoms, that officers were burdened by this responsibility. And in fact, ironically, being an authority figure in certain communities placed them at a disadvantage when it came to dealing with those folks who were remorseless or who were, seriously mentally ill or who were dispossessed and had no stake in society, that it placed great limitations on their freedom of movement rather than what people would tend to think, which is, the use of force is a first option. The novelist, Joseph Wambaugh, who happened to be writing it about the same time, he didn't write mysteries. He wrote stories about police officers, and one of his central themes was, the emotional lives of police officers and how the work affects it. And it was certainly clear to him, as well as to the sociologists, that there are moral hazards in doing police work. And being exposed to an unremitting series of moral quandaries was the way the sociologists presented it. And Wambaugh presented it as constantly dealing with the worst of people and people at their worst and trying to make sense of it, trying to stay on the on the right side of skepticism as opposed to the depleting side of cynicism, what that can do. And the theme of my paper simply was, we as a society have a significant interest in how police officers feel about their work, whether they feel supported, whether they feel folks understand the challenges they face beyond the physical courage challenges of confronting dangerous people, the moral and psychic challenges of being exposed in real time immediately after a dreadful circumstance has occurred. They're the ones that have to deal with it. They're the only parts of the social service system that deal with victims and consequences. The rest of the system is built around suspects and clients. So, interestingly enough, in many ways, that work was precursor work to the current social understanding of what combat does to soldiers. We, as a society, are abundantly aware and sensitive to notions of PTSD and subsequent stress related with the circumstances they find themselves in. But when we deal with an issue surrounding a police incident, those understandings seem to disappear and politics takes over. Mm.
We speak on the day when the city inspector, Ziskevich, is having his memorial service and was killed by teenagers who were stealing cars. Talk about the police officers involved in that must ask themselves, because I, as somebody who's been reading these reports, say, oh my gosh, these kids, they were kids, for heaven's sake, stealing cars, and they kill a beloved city inspector who's trying to make sure that the housing is decent in the city of Milwaukee. You kill somebody with a shotgun for a car? How do you make sense of any of that as an officer who encounters that?
Well, one of the reasons police officers frequently feel both frustration as well as stress is that, again, we're the only ones who deal with the victims. We are at the crime scene. Right. We see the terrible thing right after the person did the terrible thing. That's on our minds constantly. Everything else is about the suspect. And the rest of the system is a very imperfect, not an assembly line. And so what officers get enraged with, and this isn't unique to Milwaukee, is that we're dealing in high victimization locales when they see the same offenders over and over and over again. This was true in my day, and it's true today. I get on the elevator every day, and every day there are coppers on that elevator at 10 after 9, already done with court because nobody showed up, or it's postponed, or it's continued. And the suspect is on the streets, and then they arrest him again, and then they arrest him again. That is a source of great frustration to them. And so when you have an incident where everybody at this murder scene had a criminal record of some significance, and here's this man, dead at the hands of one of these individuals, it does cause them stress and anxiety, because we're the protectors. And when we do our part of the job, but we still can't protect people, it takes a toll on officers. And, time after time, as a chief in many jurisdictions, I have to keep them giving them a lecture. Keep doing your job. Keep locking them up. Sooner or later, you're locking them up enough times, somebody will incapacitate them. And what's happened is the public discussion has, for in some ways understandable reasons, fixated on how many folks are in jail for what, and that there's disparities in who's imprisoned. And unfortunately, instead of taking a scalpel to this issue, they're taking a meat axe. And so what's happening is it's become an end in itself to reduce incarceration. And all I counsel is caution, that the purpose of the criminal justice system ideally is to provide justice for victims and to protect the innocent. All right? And yes, recidivism is high because the people that get incarcerated tend to be the highest rate offenders. People forget that. And yes, if we've put too many people in jail for the wrong reasons, that needs to be examined carefully and thoughtfully. But that examination isn't occurring. And so what's happening now, bail, everybody gets bail. All right? There are folks we should hold on to. I mean, one of the murderers was out on $1,000 bail. I mean, for a serious crime. This doesn't protect people. And so, you know, there has to be a balance, all right? Where cops are not morally draconian, but they, since they see what they see, there needs to be a thoughtful balance between, obviously, alternatives to incarceration for the right offenders, first-timers, low-level offenders, et cetera. But there are dangerous people out there, and they need to be dealt with by the system while society figures out what do we do when they're little so they don't become dangerous offenders. Mm-hmm. And that's a parallel conversation that needs to take place.
Officer Mahomes, how do you prepare yourself for what you're about to see in your new career?
Well, from the training I got throughout the academy and now with my FTO, Truman Dodd, he has 15 years on it. Every situation we go to, he always explains to me thoroughly how to handle it, how to go about talking to the citizens, how to go about investigating everything that we go to.
Mm-hmm. What about the training that you receive? I'm wondering, we've heard a lot about community kind of policing, having a good understanding of the community in which you're going to be serving. Is that important? Do you have to know the people? Do you have to know the lay of the land?
Yes, I find it very important. Knowing the citizens, that they are a big part of this. They help us out find the bad guys and find the suspects that may have did anything. Talking to the citizens and knowing them by a first name basis, it makes it easier for them to come talk to us. It makes it easier for us to figure out anything that we need to find out.
Chief Flynn just outlined some of the hazards of being a police officer, worried about your physical safety, perhaps even more important, worried about your psychological well-being. Does that give you pause?
No, because when I go to work, I know I'm getting the right training. I'm getting everything I need to do. And when I go home, I'm a husband. I'm a father. I let everything go as soon as I get to the door. I see my family, my wife, my kids. They bring me back down to zero to, you know, pretty much start the day fresh.
I'm glad to hear that. What about the, and Wamba wrote about this, and you've talked about this before, the psychic damage that can happen and what you can do for police officers who are in training or after the fact when something horrendous has happened, when they've had to use physical force, when people have been yelling at them, when they're dealing with an accumulation of all these wounds that you just mentioned, Chief Flynn. What do you do about that? It can lead to alcoholism, can lead to suicide for police officers.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, Lorenzo's way of adapting is, you know, the first line of defense, which is your family and your associations off the job. You know, but the fact is, you know, this stuff accumulates. I mean, I remember when I was 25 or so and invulnerable, but it still affected me. And I came to the job armed with a liberal arts education at a time when there was abundant social research where I should certainly understand everything I was seeing in the context of social and historical forces over which people had no control that produced certain outcomes. That was one thing to know that. It was another thing to live it. And the challenge for me was maintaining some level of detachment because it is personal. One of the guys I had to read about when I was going to graduate school, I can't remember which one it was, coined the term that all police officers are Rorschach tests. They're walking Rorschach tests or ink blot tests. People look at you. You don't have to open your mouth. They have made a set of assumptions, and their attitude towards you has to do with their prior experiences with the law, their attitude towards authority, their attitude towards government in general, their sense of personal injustice, and you hadn't even done anything yet. And so it was certainly the first time in my life I'd ever felt treated like an object. And it's that objectification of police officers that enables people to go at them so aggressively. And I think, unfortunately, one of the things that affected the Pew Research findings is that the media news, you know, environment right now is so fixated on perceived or real police errors or wrongdoing that they feel like they're being objectified by the press. They don't feel this sense of nuance of, you know, for example, you know, we just had a disaster in Syria bombing a school apparently and may have killed a bunch of civilians. That's not leaping the demonization of all of our military personnel placed in harm's way. Okay, it's seen as a standalone incident. That's not accorded American policing right now. And so I think officers personalize this sense of that they're all being judged by the, you know, by the conduct of folks that have or apparently have not met our professional ideals. So I think it does accumulate on them. It also, the reality is that after you've been on the job a few years, you do find your associations narrowing. you know, your former friends don't really understand,
really,
you know, what you do. They want to ask you about something that happened elsewhere because now you're the representative of all policing. They want to talk about something that they heard. They want to, you know, with good intention, they're placing you on the defensive constantly about what your life's work is. And you find it difficult to get the right vocabulary for them. It's in some ways, it's like a combat veteran who doesn't want to talk about the war because you can't possibly understand that intensity of that reality. Well, you know, police officers, like emergency room nurses and soldiers and some other folks, they develop a dark humor as a form of relief. Hmm. You got to be very careful where you use that, because among people who like understand where you're coming from, it's just dark humor that the world can be a strange and frustrating place. But to the uninitiated, it sounds callous or uncaring or what have you. So if we're not careful, the world our officers confide in and talk to gets smaller, which reinforces if they feel bad about things. And the challenge is to keep those, you know, attachments outside the job, stay connected to your family, not burden your family too much, lest they end up, you know, constantly worrying about you. But it is a challenge over the course of a career, maintaining some level of equanimity about what you're dealing with.
Has it, Pew, looked at the issue of race in policing because of the high-profile incidents that have taken place, police officers being shot and killed, and some members of the African-American community in some cities in the country, that it has directly translated, even if you're not from that city, it's translated to a sense of police officers feeling more reluctant about using physical force, more reluctant about being open about what they're doing, feeling that they're being under siege from people in the community. Do you sense that in the Milwaukee Police Department, that these incidents have made people a little skittish who are in the force?
I think what's happened is, in many police departments, the fact of the matter is you have to engage with the community as a course of your work if you're going to have an impact on the safety of public spaces. That means the tools at our disposal are limited. You know, everybody is raised. I got these lectures from my family. You probably did. I'm sure Lorenzo did. You know, the three cardinal rules of being a kid. Mind your own business, don't stare, and don't ask embarrassing questions.
Yep.
And now you're being paid to do all three. Okay? This creates some level of stress. When a police officer gets out of the car and says, do you mind if I talk to you for a few minutes? Right away, there's a level of tenseness. Now, if this is in a high crime area with high levels of victimization, and you are in a public space, and I've never seen you before, you may have a perfectly plausible reason to be there, but now you're dealing with that ink blot test. And you know that you've been profiled, or he's going to jack you up, or he's going to harass you. Your attitude may be affected. And suddenly, that officer is getting an attitude. And since I don't know you, I'm going to say, well, what's he hiding? Why is he behaving this way? And it may just be, I've been stopped three times in this neighborhood. I don't know it's a high-crime neighborhood. I just got a thing to do. Or it may be he's one of the people that's making life miserable for the residents. I show up wearing a blue suit. You know who I am. I don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. I got to find out. And it becomes a negative, it can become a negative circumstance. And what all of our officers in every city of America have noticed is in the last 3 years, we're running into a lot more ambient hostility that's very much ripped from today's headlines. And so what would have been fairly short, normal, you know, interactions with folks in public spaces are becoming more fraught. And from time to time, it does back the cops up a little bit. I've seen occasional dips in our activity, our proactive activity. And I've noticed whenever the proactive activity, it goes down, the three things that go up are non-fatal shootings, stolen cars, and robberies, okay, without fail over the course of several years. And when the activity bubbles back up, those three metrics go down. So we've got to be doing things in public spaces besides wandering around not annoying people. But there are times right now, I think, a lot more people, particularly folks that are up to no good, are feeling much more emboldened to challenge the cops on the street because they, I mean, I've literally had cops say to me, you know, that they've confronted somebody who's kind of a suspect, and the guy will say, well, what are you going to do, shoot me? Mm. You know, and right away it's a challenge to their basic levels of authority, and as you know, Dr. Muir said years ago. In many ways, that confines the officer rather than expands their ability to react.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to that question, Officer Mahomes? Do you think that it's more difficult?
Just in my 4 weeks, just like last week, I went to a subject just to find out what was going on, and he was kind of reluctant to give me his name and information, and I was just wanting to know, like, hey, why are you, you know, standing outside this store? I got a couple of calls from citizens saying there was a subject in the area that was, you know, causing trouble. And just to talk to this person and just get the information from him, he was kind of reluctant to give me the information, and it makes it kind of hard to talk to him, you know, to figure out what's going on because they feel they, you know, being harassed. But we're just there just to get the information, just to help everyone out. And if I can stop that one subject from doing anything else and help out the citizens in the community, that makes everything better.
We have a number of people who want to speak with both of you, so we'll go to phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The overall theme of the hour is, what's a good police officer? We'll talk about this legal license to use force, which Chief Flynn reminds us is what distinguishes the police from all other agents of government. I was amazed how you would think that the use of a firearm would be something that was widely used among police officers. It's not the case. Not very many officers have used their firearms. We'll talk about that. And how difficult it may be to be, maybe it is to be an officer, particularly in these times, becoming perhaps more difficult. Here's our number. Did I give it to you? I'll do it again. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. All right, phone calls to Mary in Milwaukee. Hello, Mary.
Hello, officers. I'm just wondering, the Wisconsin state legislation is now talking about letting people carry handguns without permits and without training, and I'm just wondering how you are feeling about that. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks. Chief Lynn?
Well, obviously we're hoping that the legislature applies some modicum of common sense to some of these proposals. I know there's a new one out there to allow everyone who has a CCW permit to carry a gun into a school. And, before people think that just sounds fine, I would hasten to add that under current law, you can get a CCW permit in Wisconsin even though you meet the statutory definition of a habitual offender. So I just urge caution as we expand the locations where we want to carry firearms. And, there's a place for, ideology, and there's a place for common sense. And I think we need some common sense here.
Hmm. It was interesting in this Pew study, the number of officers versus the number of people in the general public who are not in law enforcement who believe there should be a ban on assault weapons. The general public was ahead of where police officers are in this. Is this just a difference of opinion among officers in different places all over the country? What are your thoughts about the prevalence? Well, let's talk about the prevalence of guns. And I know you're just new in the job, Officer Mahomes, but what are your thoughts about encountering somebody who may have a gun, the precautions that you may have to take, the prevalence of guns in areas you may be patrolling?
Well, you don't know. When you see someone just in public walking down the street with a gun, you don't know the intentions. And public safety is first of all. So, an average citizen sees a person walking down the street with a gun, they don't know what to think. So I have to be there, first just ask them, what are they doing walking down the street? I mean, it's their right to walk down the street with a weapon, but, the citizen don't know why that person's walking down the street with a gun. So I guess it makes it hard to weigh the options on asking that person, and then they're getting agitated about it.
Yeah, a lot of people have guns, Chief Flynn, don't they?
Good Lord, yeah. The biggest change in the life of my career, other than the things like DNA technology and body armor, has been the change in attitudes about firearms were pretty carefully regulated when I started out, generally speaking, and it was pretty much across Republican and Democratic lines. This notion, even you see the opinions about how police officers apparently feel about assault weapons, that's a cosmic shift when I was first a cop. When I was first a cop, police officer attitudes towards regulation of firearms was stronger than the general public because they're the ones facing them on the street. They wanted to make sure that whoever had one should have one. And we knew back in my day that if you saw somebody with a gun, well, you better investigate that because very few people had legal permits. And so we seized a fair amount of guns and we dealt with a fairly high level of violent crime back then. And now the even police officer attitudes have changed, which I think is more a function of the political environment than it is of, you know, any objective evaluation of how many assault weapons should be out there. You know, preponderance of officers kind of, you know, tilt conservative on a lot of issues, and, you know, the availability of firearms is one of those issues. So there's been a real change in that. God knows cops weren't liberal when I started out, but the definitions of liberal and conservative have certainly changed over the years. When it comes to how many guns are out there, people don't understand that Milwaukee per capita has more guns on the street than almost any city in America.
Really?
All right. Last year, we examined how many guns we had seized. We looked at our population and we compared it to the per capita per 100,000 people is the metric you compare cities. How many of X per 100,000 people do you have? And so we looked at Milwaukee, we looked at Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City. All right? New York City has 8.1 million people. Last year, Milwaukee had 594,000. New York City seized 3,500 firearms. Milwaukee seized 2,400. Okay? The rate per 100,000 for New York, 43. The rate per 100,000 in Milwaukee, 407.
Goodness gracious.
Okay? Now, they've got very strong firearms laws, and what's interesting about it, a lot of people went to jail for illegal possession of guns in the 90s, but now their incarceration rate has decreased because people aren't carrying guns and not shooting each other. All right? So, ironically, a short-term increase in incarceration for this offense has resulted in a long-term decrease. Let's look at Chicago. We talked about Chicago. 2.7 million people. Compared to 595,000 people. 6,600 guns last year for Chicago, 2,400 for Milwaukee. Rate per 100,000 for Chicago, 246. Rate for Milwaukee, 407. All right, so we've got a real issue here, and it transcends ideology, okay? There's no ideological solution to this. And so you have to understand, our cops are functioning in an environment here where every year there's close to 130 or 140 murders, 600 non-fatal shootings, 2,500 guns taken off the street. They use deadly force remarkably infrequently against the backdrop of that reality. And so do our police officers generally. We don't, whenever we talk about the examination of how many police officers killed last year in the light of duty, we forget. For example, that like on an average year, there's like 800 or 900 people killed in combat with police officers against the backdrop of 15,000 homicides and 300 million guns. All right? Nobody in what's so-called Western civilization has that number of firepower or murdered people as we do. And against that backdrop, police officers in routine encounters still have to have a sense of, I may be in danger here. Okay? And that creates a level of ambient stress that few people recognize or take into account when they examine this phenomenon.
Yeah, a lot of stress, I'm sure. Thanks very much, Mary, for your call. Let's go next to Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen and officers. I'm a cop mom. I have four children. Two of my sons are policemen, one in Merced County, California. He's a sheriff's deputy. My other son he's not going to hear it. He's in racing. He's a patrolman. Actually, it was a couple of years ago because where our political ideologies are different. My son is a good man, and I'm terrified every evening because he's a target. That blue light in his squad makes him a target. He and his partner were called to a situation. The man was belligerent. Later found out he was schizophrenic. They had to use force. And there was a Black Lives Matter protest shortly afterwards. I just found this out. I'm heartbroken. Damning my son and the other officer. And my son has changed. And we don't talk. We don't talk about anything. What can I do for him?
Chief Lynn.
Well, first, I want to thank you for raising your children in an environment where they're willing to devote their lives to public service under difficult and challenging circumstances. I mean, it's a tribute to you and your value system that two of your children decided to take this line of work. We do tend to focus on the negative. And in some ways, I feel like our police officers today are being treated like the Vietnam veterans of another generation, where whatever bad thing happened in Vietnam or whatever your position was on the war, you took it out on the soldier. And over the years, we learned to say, you know, don't blame the soldier for the war. And the challenge here is, unfortunately, too many people are using the police as a way to generate a constituency rather than to solve problems. Now, one of the Pew study findings was there's a difference between how black and white officers looked yes. at the motivations of demonstrators. And I completely get that, because often they're going to have different life experiences and different associations off the job that are going to influence their opinion. But we can see that there is some agreement. White officers don't see the many of these demonstrators as legitimate because they believe in what they're doing and they know they're not out there purposely, you know, trying to harass people. They believe they're trying to achieve a just end. I think African-American officers often have a more nuanced view of the motivations of the varieties of people in these demonstrations. And the term of art in the survey was symptoms of a broader problem. And I would say, yes, they're both right. Okay? Cops are trying to do the right thing. They're not getting out of their cars to have fun harassing people. The worst examples of racist behavior on the part of officers I saw as a cop coming up was apathy, not getting involved. Their attitude was, let them do what they're going to do. We'll sort it out when it's over. Okay? They weren't going to take risks. They weren't going to engage and risk getting yelled at. They didn't want to do their job. Wanting to do your job doesn't make you a racist. But the broader problem is this. The disparate impact of crime on poor people of color in central cities is a very real symptom of a broader problem. Intergenerational poverty, disorganized families, substandard housing, and poor school outcomes translate into the visible symptom of violence. And violence's most heavy hand is on the poor. They're overrepresented in every violent crime victimization category. There is a broader problem, but it's broader than the police alone. And focusing only on the police is a form of cheap grace. Police departments are going to always get additional training. They're always going to try to accommodate the community concerns. But the bigger problems are, what are we doing about this endless cycle of producing more crime victims and more young offenders? And that's a conversation nobody's having. And all I can say to you, Mom, when it comes to your kids, is you got to love them and support them and invite them to tell their story. And if they don't, then just love and support them. Young cops have a tough adjustment around 7 years on the job. Very frequently, 7 to 10 years are kind of a danger year where the idealism they brought to the job has been consistently challenged by the harsh reality of what they're dealing with. And how they come through that, most of them come through it more grown up with a little bit more perspective. But some of them have a real tough emotional time, and sometimes the best idealists have the toughest emotional time dealing with their with their changing attitudes. Mm-hmm. And so avoid politics, okay? Because nobody's politics fixes this. Nobody's, left or right. Believe me, I'm done with both of them. But what can fix it is recognizing he's trying to do good work under certain circumstances, giving him your unqualified support about that, and not talking about politics, because that's not helping anybody.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question that was in Pew, Officer Mahomes, and recognizing the fact that your ultimate boss is sitting next to you. And
No pressure. It's okay, Lorenzo. No worries.
Just starting on the force. But what about this whole issue of race? Do you think, as a new member of the force, that is this perception of the community toward officers, the differences between perception of possibility to get ahead among black officers and white officers is very, very different. And we've also heard from many of those highly publicized cases that there have been problems with some racist members of police departments in some forces throughout the country. How do you feel you're trained to deal with that? How does the department feel it's trained? And do you see differences in how the world is perceived? Are there dramatic differences if you're a white officer or if you're a black officer?
I think we're trained to handle it professionally. You know, we pretty much just got to get ahead of the narrative that the media is trying to put out there, you know, with the police officers, and show them that, you know, that we're all trained professionally to handle this situation the way it's, you know, supposed to be. And like I could say to the caller, all you can do for your sons is just, you know, let them know that you love them, let them know that you're doing the right thing, and when they come, just go to them. Because with me and my mother, I talk to her probably every day after my shift, let her know something.
That's a good son.
Let her know.
I like to hear that.
Let her know some things that I have done throughout the day, if it's not, you know, too gruesome or anything. But just let her know that I had a good day, I learned a lot, and that my day went good and my training's going good. So the thing I can try to tell the caller for her is to go to her sons. If she can't get a hold of them, just go to them and talk to them. If they don't want to share what's going on, just talk to them about anything, just to get them to break away from the situation that they're going through. Because sometimes what we need is just to talk to someone about something else.
Right. Well, and you, Chief Lynn, the last time you were here, you talked about how police departments are very often now becoming social service agencies that you have to deal with. And a number of people who are mentally ill, as her son had to deal with somebody who was mentally ill and violent toward her, you become the first line of defense when it comes to helping somebody get out of poverty, in a sense.
Well, that was my biggest shock as a young copper many, many years ago, is that I'd spent all this time learning about the laws of arrest, search, and seizure, and the criminal law and the criminal code. And then I was in this environment where, like, almost no call I went to was the criminal law any good to me at all. You know, what I was finding and what police officers have found generation after generation is we're the social service of first resort, not last resort, first resort, particularly for the poor. All right. These are frequently neighborhoods that don't have social bonds. There aren't informal social controls. People don't know each other. They're forced by circumstance to live in housing that nobody would want to live in, which means their neighbors aren't always the nicest people in the world. Their family structures are frequently challenged by unemployment, by family abandonment issues and whatnot. And so these disordered lives have problems that lots of other folks don't ever have. Mm-hmm. And they can't turn to anybody. They don't have a social network. They don't have strong familial bonds. Mom's not going to fix it. You know, mom's got her own substance abuse problems. And so the police get called. And whether it's, we handle everything from babies to old people, everything in the middle, and there aren't places to take them. And that is one of the great stressors of police work, is it's providing provisional solutions to intractable social problems. Okay? I started out policing before the years of mandatory arrests. So how did you handle a family dispute if there wasn't any blood on the floor? You tried to talk people into some sort of accommodation. You got somebody to walk around the block. You got somebody to find another place to stay at the night. You had no tools. And what do we look at it today? You know, when we deinstitutionalized the mentally ill back in the 70s and 80s, we were going to have this broad array of community-based mental health facilities that never came to pass. And so what do we have? All right, we have officers who have to have crisis intervention training, but we can't place them anywhere. We can't take them to a facility where somebody will care for them overnight. They're released right back into the neighborhood. We have homeless population, many of them dual diagnosed, alcohol or drug dependent and mentally ill. What do we have? Well, we have police homeless outreach teams, but we don't have a place where they can sleep at night very frequently or sufficient beds to do that. We have an exploding opioid crisis. What do we have? Cops with Narcan. I mean, there's no social problem so complicated America can't dump it in the laps of the coppers and then attack them because they haven't fixed it. All right, in their spare time, oh, yes, there's crimes of violence and property crime they have to respond to.
Lynn, all the best to you. Thanks for your call. Angie in Appleton. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Actually, I have a comment, and that is, you know, with cops, all these situations that they're put in, why is it that they don't see psychologists so that, because they are experiencing PTSD, so that we are addressing that professionally?
Yeah. Are you addressing it?
Well, the industry is taking it on. I mean, we've hired a psychologist here. We have an early intervention program that looks to identify stressors in officers' lives that may be precursors of them having a problem later on. But there are challenges here. If I was going to create the tertiary levels of challenges, number one, police officers are folks who feel a need to be in control of themselves, and they feel society expects them to control themselves. And one of the challenges of coppers with alcohol is self-medication to deal with stress and anxiety. And that's as old as the business. Related to that is the act of seeking help is sometimes fraught. We got a terrible circumstance right now where the police department is being sued about something right here in federal court. We've got an early intervention program. We've told officers it's confidential. We've told officers we want to help them get counseling or whatever they need because we've seen some precursor activities. I just had a judge rule that we had to make all that available to the person suing us. That suddenly all this confidentiality is blown up. Now, nobody would dream of doing that to the VA. Okay, but we're just easy marks. Oh, yes, I think it's relevant to this case. Let's look and see what the department's history is with EIP. So, you know, that kind of thing makes officers reluctant to engage the system and say, you know what, I've been a little worried about this, and I think I'm drinking a little bit too much, or I've been taking sick days. Help me out here. So, you know, the caller's right. And many departments, including ourselves, are working to make available to our officers the right kind of services and to certainly remove the stigma. And I think this generation of officers, it's less of a stigma asking for help than previous generations. But it's, you know, it's not done without risk given the current litigious environment.
Mm. Sure you want to carry on with this work, Officer Mahomes?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Why do you want to be a police officer?
Because I love the community. I've been in Milwaukee for over 13 years, and I've seen it grow and what it's become, and I love it. I love to help out and help the people. I mean, I know the city, so I know it's more good than bad, so I want to get there and help it become more good than what it is now.
Yeah. Is the training rough?
The training's rough, but I made it through the academy. I'm proud. I graduated class leader in my class. So
you did?
Yes, ma'am.
Congratulations.
Something else I want to keep in mind right now, we're still recruiting. And unless I spend 50 minutes telling people about all the dreadful things that's going to happen to their children if they expose themselves to this vocation, let me stop for a moment and say, yes, I mean, there are hazards in being a surgeon, okay? Sure. There are hazards in opening chests and knowing you're going to lose some of your patients. I mean, any profession which devotes itself to life and death circumstances is going to impose great pressures on its practitioners. But I would also say this is a life of service that requires courage, that requires sincerity of purpose, that requires a sense of honor and a sense of justice. And it is a real tribute to young people and their parents for those who want to step forward and actively say, I want to help those in need, I want to protect those who are vulnerable, and I want to keep my community safe even if it imposes physical risks on me. And that's still very real. And we're fortunate that there are still young people in this country willing to step forward and accept physical and even emotional risk because the stakes are high. A free society is desperately dependent upon a competent, capable, professional, restrained police authority. All right. There's so many diversities of opinion and attitude and demands in this society. We've got to have societal umpires, if you will, who are respected, professional, fair, and courageous. And that's an occupation that's worth the attention of the best of our young people, whatever their background is. And I think Lorenzo's a wonderful example of that.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number, a couple lines are open. We're talking about what it takes to be a good police officer, the stresses on police officers, and the reason for the conversation. We'd have it anyway, but we read this very interesting research study done by Pew, and they did interviews with 8,000 police officers all over the country asking about the good parts and the bad parts concerning their jobs, and their findings were interesting, and so we thought that we would ask the same kinds of questions to Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn, and Police Officer Lorenzo Mahomes is also with us. He has just graduated, actually, from the Milwaukee Police Academy and is in his first 6 weeks of field training as an officer. Our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, for more phone calls. Betsy in River Falls, hi.
Hi. First of all, Kathleen, I would like to say thank you for having this program. And Chief Flynn, I ask this very respectfully. I do not understand why there are so many high-speed chases when it must be scaring the bejesus out of both the cops and the person being chased, and it doesn't seem to end up very well. I just wondered why, sir.
Well, thanks for the question. Interestingly enough, I've been taking a lot of criticism because of the significant limitations I've put on vehicle pursuits here in Milwaukee. I agree with what's embedded in your premise, which is why are we chasing certain cars in the first place? And although I would say certainly today's officers have far better training in vehicle pursuit techniques, evasive driving techniques than I ever had, the fact of the matter remains that those are inherently dangerous to police officers and citizens alike. Two officers that I lost in the line of duty in my first police chief jobs were killed in a police pursuit. So I'm very aware of this, of the costs. We imposed the strongest limitation in the entire state, actually, on our pursuits. Officers aren't allowed to chase cars for only property crimes. They're not only to they don't even chase cars that are only stolen. We'll chase a car taken in a carjacking because that's a violent crime and therefore a violent criminal. But we don't just chase stolen cars. And I've taken a real beating over that from some political quarters as though I was encouraging crime. But nobody goes to jail for stealing a car. We did the analysis. If you get caught in a stolen car, you're charged with operating it, not stealing it, and you get probation. So I'm risking the lives of officers and citizens to catch somebody for a car for which they will not suffer a significant sanction. So I take what you say very seriously. I think it's something the profession has to constantly reexamine. But this is the one police department in the state, I'll tell you for sure, that that carefully examines that that tactic and tries to use it as sparingly as possible.
Thanks, Betsy. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Just a comment for the chief and also for the new officer, that when the issue came up about black and white police officers are facing the issues of race. I had experience 16 and a half years with law enforcement, and I saw it then, and I see it still today. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's a societal issue that there's still a lot of prejudice in this country, and the unfortunate thing is it's in the face of law enforcement every day, and it's not in the face of the rest of society. And I wish society would start addressing the issue like the law enforcement does. Those are some of the best trained people today to deal with the issues of race and discrimination. And unfortunately, the rest of society just sitting back just sitting back. Good luck to you, young officer. I forget the name, but good luck in your career.
Lorenzo, thanks very much for the call. And let's go to one more phone call. We're almost out of time, about a minute left. Ludine, is it, in Pulaski? Hi, Ludine.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have worked Child Protective Services for 29 years, and I just felt the need to come in and call in and say thank you to all of the officers out there who worked with us to keep kids safe and who have kept us safe while we're doing our job. Social workers tend to be liberal and officers tend to be conservative. And when it comes out to doing that job, we put that aside. And, you know, it's a great team, great relationship. And you guys do so much for the mental health issue, Child Protective Services, and all that other stuff that social workers couldn't do our jobs if we didn't have you. And I just wanted to say thank you.
That was really nice.
Thank you.
You don't hear thank yous that often, I guess.
No,
huh?
Say you're welcome, Lorenzo.
And an indication of just how widespread the job duties are, too.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was an interesting hour. I appreciate your being here in our studios. Thanks.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for allowing this perspective into the public discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. We should all read Joseph Wambaugh, right?
Yeah, you have to find him on Amazon now, though. I don't think he's published anything in a while, but it's worth reading.
That's all right. The chief is going to write a novel. He just needs a little bit of time to be able to do that. Thanks very much to Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, and we also thank Police Officer Lorenzo Mahomes and wish him well. He's just started his new job. Thanks to Scotty Myers, who isn't with us anymore, but produced this show. Thanks, Scotty. We miss you. Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We're going to return and talk about spelling, and it's one of those rare hours we actually have a prize to the person who can correctly. On air, there will be a bit of pressure spell a certain word that might be hard to spell, so that's coming up. Thanks very much for listening and for your calls.